From Hawaii to Maine, Oregon to Georgia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United States and Israel have destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities. Jake Novak of the American Sunrise Early Edition is here to talk about the impact of the war between Israel and Iran. Efforts to pass the One Big Beautiful Reconciliation Bill by July 4th are proving to be difficult. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth joins us with the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute about Republican attempts to rein in spending on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, or SNAP, program. And Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on how a baseball tradition explains Iran's calculated response to the destruction of its nuclear facilities by the United States. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A shaky ceasefire is underway in the war between Israel and Iran, and the United States has inflicted a devastating blow to Iranian nuclear ambitions. Here to discuss the impact is Jake Novak. He is author of Jake's Takes on Substack and host of the American Sunrise Early Edition on Real America's Voice channel. Jake, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jake, Israel, of course, launched an attack on Iran, which was very close to gaining the capability to deliver nuclear warheads. From your experience working for the Israeli consulate, keeping a very close eye on all of these activities, why the timing? Why, over the last couple of weeks, did this action finally occur?
Well, some of it had to do with the facts on the ground, and some of it had to do with the facts over a couple of years leading into the situation. The facts on the ground from Israeli intelligence point of view is that Iran was able, even at that moment, a couple of weeks ago, to start putting together a nuclear warhead. Maybe it would have been a prototype. Maybe it would have been something that was just a test. It may not have been functional, but that is too far a line cross, well beyond the line that Israel had publicly told the world for decades they would not accept being crossed. So that was one thing. But then there was another thing with just the general trends. You know, Iran was completely behind the funding and the training and the planning of the October 7th terror attacks in October 7, 2023. And that was an all-out horrific attack that led, there was no taboo that was respected. Again, not to get too gory, but we know that babies were put in ovens. There was a massive killing of well over 1,000 people, unarmed civilians, and on down the line. Where Iran, for those people who may have thought politically may be possibly moderating, or maybe they wouldn't be as destructive, it was clear that there was no line they wouldn't cross. So the combination of their functional advancement in the nuclear program and their theoretical and ideological continuing further, getting even more radicalization, was the reason why the go time had been decided at that moment.
A number of folks on the left have been commenting here, Jake, that back during the Obama administration, a deal was made with Iran to rein in their nuclear capabilities. And, well, now Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump have, quote, violated it in their view. But looking back, that agreement that Obama made, has Iran ever really stuck to it? And have they not continued to enrich uranium, to move toward getting a nuclear weapon, to promote terrorism in the intervening years?
That's right. I mean, and don't take our word for it. Don't take President Trump's word for it. Don't take Republicans' word for it or pro-Israel Democrats' word for it. Take the UN and their own IAEA, that's a part of the UN, their own nuclear watchdog group. And they're certainly no friends of Israel. They are certainly no friends of the United States. And they themselves acknowledge on many occasions when the deal was in place and when it was not in place that Iran was breaking the rules of the deal, was enriching uranium in new locations that they had not disclosed. There is absolutely no honest or sane person who will say that Iran was adhering to the aspects of the deal, even when it was in place under Barack Obama. The narrative that Trump broke the deal during his first term and then again broke it in his second, and that's the reason why Iran went back to really working hard towards getting nuclear weapons. It's just a lie. No honest person can say that. Especially when the UN, which is certainly no right-wing organization, is basically saying the same thing. So it's very ludicrous to say that. Now, you can argue that there may have been another way to deal with this. That's a different discussion. But to say that the existing deals that President Obama put into place and then Joe Biden put back into place were working and were protecting and keeping the world safe is just real fantasy land territory.
President Trump, a little over a week ago, decided to get the United States involved in this conflict militarily, dropping those bunker-busting bombs. Do you think it was an appropriate time for the United States to engage?
Yeah, and that has a lot to do with tactical aspects of this situation. With the Iranian air defenses, such as they were before the war, now completely knocked out by the Israelis, with the fact that they had no air force to speak of anymore, with the fact that there was a real leadership crisis going on in Iran, we still don't know if the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is alive or certainly functionally in charge. We don't know any of those things. There couldn't be a better and more safe time to send any amount of American military presence over the skies of Iran as we had on Saturday night. I mean, that really was tactically the best time. Whether it was politically the best time or not, I would also say it was as well. But I'm willing to entertain the argument that we could have had another way to go about this. Maybe allow Israel to continue its attacks and see if they could even be made even weaker to the point that they might actually walk out of some of those sites with white flags, which was something I was fantasizing might happen. So we could make the argument that politically there might have been a better time, but it certainly wasn't a bad time politically. This is not a time when Iran's political leaders were really strong, and it certainly wasn't a time when Iran's foreign allies, if they even can be called allies anymore, were standing up for them. I mean, there's been statements on paper by Russia and China and a few others, but this is a dog not barking. I mean, there couldn't be a better political time from the point of view of foreign relations, because these so-called allies of Iran have been mostly quiet. And even when they're not quiet, they're certainly not doing anything. So I think that politically, it was almost the best time that you could possibly hope for. Tactically and militarily, absolutely, is certainly a prime time.
So all of the doomsday commentary about what would happen if the United States did get involved seems to have not come to pass, as you pointed out. Iran's so-called allies not really doing very much. There's been sort of an on-again, off-again ceasefire over the last few days. Is it possible for that to actually take effect, considering we don't really even know who's in charge in Iran anymore?
Yeah, no, I think it will, because this is typical. In the situations with Israel, Israel's enemies, which basically have all been funded by Iran primarily now for over 10 years. There used to be a lot of funders of Israel's terrorist enemies. Now it's just Iran. But these quote-unquote ceasefires always start this way. The ceasefires they've had with Hamas and Hezbollah in the past, the first day or two are very, very bumpy. Hezbollah and Hamas fires off more rockets. They kill some more people. They get in some last licks, so to speak. And Israel has to retaliate one more time, and then it takes effect. That's what's happening here. I think that it will hold. I think it will hold for a period of months at least. It could go on for longer than that. But I have a feeling that this ceasefire will hold for the most part. This, you know, don't call me on it if there's one or two incidents. But I think the ceasefire will probably hold for at least a 3 to 4 month period. I would actually think it will last through the end of the year, and then we'll see what happens after that. But I do think it will hold. But just understand, this is a very familiar pattern for people who have been watching this for years. This is how ceasefires have gone with Hezbollah and Hamas as well. Similar pattern.
Jake Novak of Jake's Takes and a new television show. So, Jake, tell us a little bit about your new program.
Yeah, we're at the six-month mark for a show I anchor, produce, and book the guests and do all the writing. It's called American Sunrise Early Edition. It's on the Real America's Voice channel, which you can get on all the streaming networks. It's also on some cable systems, but you can get it on all the streamers, Roku, Amazon Prime. You can watch it on X. You can watch it on Getter and Rumble, Apple TV, and on down the line. And that's at 7 a.m. Eastern every Monday through Friday. So this is a morning news program. You can get up all the news. There's commentary on the show, but it's primarily getting you up to date on all the major news of the day. With the expert guests and myself, Monday through Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. on Real America's Voice.
Jake Novak. Jake, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson has for months now been keeping track of the progress of the reconciliation bill that's now before the U.S. Senate, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. There is a key player here who's not actually elected by anyone, and we're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
It's called the Byrd Rule, and this has to do with the reconciliation process, somewhat in the weeds, but nonetheless could be pivotal in this discussion. Scott, tell us what the Byrd Rule is and why the Senate parliamentarian has now become a key player.
Well, you got to kind of go all the way back to the Congressional Budget Act of 1974, which implements budget resolution policies affecting what's known as mandatory spending, really the permanent spending and revenue programs that Congress does not deal with on an annual basis like they do in the so-called omnibus appropriation bills or in the individual 12 appropriation bills, if we could ever actually get to them. A lot of the listeners are also pretty familiar with the continuing resolution. That's discretionary spending that Congress will vote on with a 60-vote margin on cloture in the Senate every year. And, you know, the fiscal year runs through September 30th, begins on October 1st. But reconciliation and legislation that's been passed with reconciliation sort of started in 1980. There's been 23 total reconciliation bills that have been enacted into law. And during the first few years of reconciliation, some of these bills contained provisions that were extraneous for the purposes of implementing budget resolution policies. And so in the mid-80s, the Senate adopted what's known as the Byrd Rule, and that was named after a longtime senator, Robert Byrd. And the idea of the Byrd Rule was to curb the practice of adding these extraneous provisions and really limit reconciliation to spending, revenues, or the debt limit increase. And basically, you've got this person in the United States Senate that is a staffer appointed by the majority leader, and they are sort of the referee of what is permitted under the Byrd Rule, and they make rulings and advise the chair, which is the president of the Senate, and usually that's the vice president, in these, you know, very, very tight votes. And so if you overrule the ruling of the parliamentarian, it sort of is viewed as the nuclear option and abolishing the filibuster. So even though there's only been one instance where the parliamentarian was overruled, that was actually in 1975. And it happened on a budget process question, not on the adjudication of legislative provisions through a reconciliation bill. However, there has been one instance in 2001 where the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott, fired the parliamentarian, a guy named Robert Dove, and he said, you know what, I want somebody in here that's going to be more neutral and, you know, adjudicate these questions in a nonpartisan way. I'm dissatisfied with this appointment, so I'm going to put somebody new in. The current parliamentarian is a woman named Elizabeth McDonough, and she was appointed by Democrat Majority Leader Harry Reid. She's been in the position for a real long time, is highly experienced going through the rulings that, you know, she has to make on reconciliation through the Byrd Bath, which is basically when each provision of a reconciliation bill is scrubbed by the parliamentarian after these arguments are made by Republican and Democrat Senate staff. So basically, she hears out both sides of the arguments, and, you know, the Democrats are going to really raise points of order on almost every provision and try to say, hey, we think that this is extraneous because it's affecting policy more than budget in terms of spending and revenues. And, you know, sometimes it does seem like the parliamentarian is sort of licking her finger, putting it up in the air, and trying to figure out which way the political winds are blowing. And, you know, she has to determine on almost a weighted scale, is this merely incidental or is it extraneous? And are we going to punt this provision from the bill? We've been dealing with that all week in Washington, D.C. The Senate Democrats have been bragging through various press releases saying that they've won arguments to basically strip out the Republican Senate proposal on limiting the state Medicaid expansion provider tax from 6% phased down to 3.5%. This is a way that the states basically get major payments from the federal government to help cover their costs in the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. And, you know, that's not the program that's supposed to be protecting the disabled, the pregnant, the low-income folks that are unable to work. Instead, it has created a scenario where tens of millions of Americans and illegal aliens are receiving coverage in Medicaid at a higher reimbursement rate, where 90% of the funds are covered by the federal government and only 10% of the funds are covered by the states. And it has basically just dumped all these healthy people, able-bodied individuals, into the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. That's a real problem. It's become incredibly costly. And unfortunately, the parliamentarian this week is telling Republicans, you've got to rewrite these provisions. Otherwise, I'm going to say that you have created a corrosive process, and we're going to subject this reconciliation bill to the full filibuster and cloture like a normal bill would be processed through the United States Senate. So you've got all these lawmakers and folks that are working on the drafting, and they're rewriting those provisions as we speak.
Well, we, of course, will continue to keep an eye on this, as we have now for months, with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. With this one big, beautiful bill, we're fighting hard to keep your taxes low and make sure that we're avoiding the largest tax increase in our nation's history. If you want to check out our work and what we've been doing on the tax plan, check us out at clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Costs of the SNAP or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program have ballooned out of control. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is joined by Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute to discuss GOP efforts to preserve the program for the truly needy.
The so-called Big Beautiful Bill is, of course, mostly focused on extending the 2017 tax cuts, but that's not the only thing in there. And as the bill is being worked on by the Senate, one detail that's gotten some attention in the media recently has been the supposed cuts to the food stamp program included in the bill. But calling those cuts is missing some important context and nuance about the food stamp program. And that's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Chris Edwards. He is the Kiltz Family Chair in Fiscal Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And he's written extensively in recent years about the food stamp program, or the SNAP program, as it is officially known. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, otherwise known as food stamps. And he joins us now to fill in some of that nuance and context that is often missing in this debate. Chris, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of stuff in this bill, the big tax bill that the Republicans are trying to get through Congress right now. Broad strokes, tell me what the Republican Senate bill would do with regard to the SNAP program.
Well, the food stamp program, also called SNAP, has soared in cost in recent years, and Republicans are trying to create two modest trims to the program. One is they're trying to increase the share of the program that's paid for by the states. Currently, the feds pay for all of the benefits for food stamps, and the Republicans are asking states to pay maybe 5 to 15% of the cost of the benefits. The other thing that Republicans want to do is tighten the work requirements for SNAP, so that people are able to work, are not just sitting on their couch and collecting food stamps. They're right in the workforce.
Let's talk about the increase in recent years, because I think that's the really important context for this debate, is how the cost of this program has really soared, especially since the pandemic. And that has to do with something that Biden did, not through Congress. This was an executive order to kind of change the way the benefits are structured there.
That's right. Back in 2019, just before COVID hit, the food stamp program cost $60 billion a year. It now costs $110 billion a year. Part of the increase was because Biden, by executive fiat, boosted benefits in SNAP across the board by 21%. This was a pretty outrageous action, actually, because usually it's Congress that has and should be responsible for changing benefit levels in the program, but Biden, just by executive action, boosted benefits across the board by 21%. So Republicans should at least be working to eliminate and reverse out that increase.
Yeah, that's one of the things that just drives me crazy when you hear these stories, you know, all this stuff in the media about cuts to food stamps. You know, you didn't hear anything when Biden increased the cost of the program. You only ever hear about it when you have members of Congress trying to roll back the costs of that program. Chris, you mentioned this earlier. I want to get a little deeper into it. You know, you mentioned the cost sharing between the feds and the states. That's a big piece of what's in this bill. And with food stamps, that's really kind of an outlier when it comes to, you know, other welfare programs or other programs, any sort of subsidies like this that the federal government hands out. Oftentimes these things are shared between the states and the feds, and that's just not the case with food stamps.
That's right. I mean, I think the federal government ought to get out of all these state and local welfare programs. There's no advantage for federal involvement in these. If the states want to run welfare programs, that's up to them. I think the feds ought to get out of this. But, you know, if you look at other welfare and federal aid to state programs like highways or Medicaid, the federal government asks states to pay a substantial share of the cost, maybe 40 or 50%. The SNAP or food stamp program is an outlier. The federal government pays 100% of the cost of the benefit. So the Republicans are saying, hey, we think the states ought to pay maybe up to 15% of the cost here, and that creates some more skin in the game. I mean, under the current structure, if the federal government is paying 100% of the benefits, and the states are administering the program, the states have no incentive to stamp out fraud and abuse in the program. And indeed, there's tons of fraud and abuse in SNAP, partly because the state governments have no incentive to manage the program in an efficient manner.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of federalism, so I like that. I like that. I think the state's got to put some skin in the game here. We are talking with Chris Edwards. He's the chair of fiscal studies at the Cato Institute. We're talking about the food stamp changes, the SNAP benefit changes that are included in the big reconciliation bill working its way through Congress. Chris, not a lot of time left here, but I want to end on this because it's something that you've noted to me in our conversations before coming on the air here. And it's about the kind of interesting dynamic that's developed as this bill has been making its way through Congress, where you've got these the food stamp spending cuts, but then at the same time, Republicans are trying to increase farm subsidies. Those are, you know, technically two different things, but how do they work together?
Well, every few years, Republicans and Democrats want to pass a big farm subsidy bill, and the Republicans haven't been able to pass their farm subsidy bill in recent years. So what they're doing is they've jammed all these farm subsidy increases into this big reconciliation bill. You know, reconciliation bills, as you know, Eric, are supposed to be for reducing deficits, but Republicans are using this bill to hike farm subsidies, which are welfare for high-income people. So, frankly, liberal critics have a bit of a point when they say, hey, Republicans are trying to trim low-income welfare, but they're boosting high-income welfare with food subsidies, or farm subsidies. So there is an unfairness here. I think we ought to cut welfare for low-income people and high-income farmers. That's the way to reduce deficits.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, we're running a $2 trillion deficit right now, and bigger deficits in the future. It looks like this bill is going to add to those deficits, if you believe most of the economists and budget analysts who have looked at it. So, yeah, I mean, I don't understand how you can be adding more subsidies here. We've got to cut spending, folks. We've got to cut spending. That's the most important thing. That is, unfortunately, all the time we have for today. Chris, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks, Eric.
And once again, that is Chris Edwards. He is the Kiltz Family Chair in Fiscal Studies at the Cato Institute. Check out his work at cato.org, including the pieces that he's written recently on the food stamp program. Find our coverage of the Big Beautiful Bill and everything else going on around the country this week at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Iran's measured response to the destruction of its nuclear facilities by the United States can be explained by a baseball tradition. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
We are in the heart of the baseball season, and there's a lesson or an insight from baseball that can help us understand the dynamics among Israel Iran, and America. I certainly don't want this analogy to trivialize the conflict. It has roots that go back thousands of years, and with today's mega weapons, it has the potential to flare up into World War III or worse, a truly existential apocalyptic struggle. But I suggest that there is an aspect of human nature at work here that a comparison with baseball can help illuminate. In baseball, there's something called the codes. The codes are a set of unwritten rules that are rules nonetheless. One of the better-known codes involves a pitcher and a batter. If a pitcher on Team A is perceived to have intentionally hit a batter on Team B, then Team B is compelled by the codes to strike back, typically by having the Team B pitcher retaliate by hitting a batter on Team A. The question is, how hard? An unskilled observer would look at any retaliation as an escalation and any failure to retaliate as submission and thus a loss of honor. But the unwritten code of baseball allows a retaliation that de-escalates the contest while preserving honor. If the first hit was minor, the retaliation could be as simple as a brushback pitch. If the first hit was a beanball, a hit on the batter's head, then the retaliatory hit might be on the arm or the leg. It will hurt, or it doesn't meet the code, but it won't hurt as much as the first hit, the beanball. But if the retaliation is harder than the initial hit, a hard pitch to the throat or the head powerful enough to knock the batter to the ground, for example, then that's an escalation, and a bench-clearing brawl is the likely next scene. On the night of Saturday, June 21st, America hit Iran with a beanball, a shot right to the head. It was targeted and precise. It could have been even more powerful, but it wasn't. It was surgical. Iran's sense of honor compelled a response. Honor and pride are deeply held values in Iranian culture. The response was measured, an attack on a nearby American military base, but not a cataclysmic one. It may have even been preceded by some kind of warning. Iran's honor was preserved, but the conflict was not escalated. Then President Trump called it very weak, which was humiliating. Humiliation required another retaliation. The code demanded it, and Iran satisfied the retirement of the code by firing another round of missiles, this time aimed at America's ally Israel, not another American base, violating the hastily announced ceasefire. This time, President Trump responded with exceptional verbal bluster, even dropping an F-bomb on national television, but not another bombing. The retaliations followed the same code as the baseball code. If both sides will leave things where they stand at this moment, and I am recording this commentary several days before you hear it, then the ceasefire has a chance to develop into an end to the conflict. Each side can claim to be in favor of peace. The baseball codes exist and continue to be a force in spite of not being written because they are based on a profound understanding of human psychology. We must hope and pray that the same kind of understanding prevails among Iran, Israel, and the United States. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGNE-FM in Jacksonville, Florida, KSOK-AM in Arkansas City, Kansas, along with WBBZ-AM in Ponca City, Oklahoma. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.